Hi, I'm Beth Gibbs, and every week at this time, Chris takes a look at the current issues of For Your Health. Our first article is titled, There's a Life-Saving Drug Treatment in Connecticut. The Problem? Getting to it isn't easy. By Andrew Brown for the Connecticut Mirror. State officials and nonprofit providers are spending millions of dollars to increase access to methadone in Connecticut and to eliminate one of the biggest barriers to that opioid treatment medication, travel times. Several of the state's methadone providers are in the process of siting and opening new methadone treatment centers in Connecticut, including the first clinic of its kind in Middlesex County. At the same time, state officials are preparing to spend more than $4 million from a pool of opioid settlement funds to outfit two new methadone vans, which will be capable of dispensing the vital medication to patients in more isolated corners of the state. Those investments are key to Connecticut's larger goal of expanding medication-assisted treatment in the state, including methadone, which is widely considered to be the most effective treatment for people with a history of using heroin, fentanyl, or prescription painkillers. In some sections of Connecticut, it can take more than 45 minutes to drive to the closest methadone treatment center. There are roughly 30 inpatient clinics located throughout Connecticut that dispense methadone to individuals seeking treatment for opioid use disorders. But with many of those federally licensed centers located in the state's larger cities, there is concern that pockets of Connecticut still don't have a level of access that is necessary to combat the ongoing opioid epidemic, which claimed the lives of more than 6,300 Connecticut residents in the past 5 years. To highlight that point, a team of researchers from Yale University and Virginia Tech University recently completed a study for Connecticut that calculated how long it takes for residents in every part of the state to travel by car, bus, or train to the nearest methadone clinic. That analysis showed that for people living in and around cities like Waterbury, Hartford, Danbury, New Haven, Bridgeport, Stamford, Torrington, Norwich, and New London, it often takes less than 15 minutes by car to get to the nearest methadone clinic. But in other sections of Connecticut, it can take more than 45 minutes to drive to the closest treatment center, which can be a major impediment for people who are undergoing methadone treatment while also attempting to maintain a job or care for their families. Quote, imagine being stuck in traffic, knowing that you have to get dosed, and you have to get back to work, or you have to get your kid on the school bus, said Nancy Navarretta, the commissioner of the Connecticut Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. Unsurprisingly, the time commitment is even bigger for people who don't have access to a car. Large swaths of Connecticut have no public transportation, and even in places that do, the researchers found it can take more than 2 hours in some instances for people to get from their homes to a methadone clinic via public transit. During the early stages of methadone treatment, patients are often required to travel to the clinics daily for therapy and their liquid dose of methadone, which helps to reduce the most severe symptoms of opioid withdrawal. Benjamin Howell, one of the Yale researchers who conducted the travel study for the state, said that means some people who are in the initial phases of treatment could spend 3 to 4 hours per day on a bus just to receive their medication. That can be a major deterrent for people suffering from the most serious opioid use disorder, said Howell, because illicit narcotics like heroin and fentanyl can be more easily available to those individuals than the medication-assisted treatment. These are the people we should be championing, the people who are deciding to go get treatment, said Howell. We should be supporting those people as much as we can and lowering the barrier as much as we can. Doug Schumann knows all too well the burden that travel times can present when attempting to access methadone treatment in Connecticut. From 2015 to earlier this year, Schumann has been making the journey from his home in Middletown to a clinic in Hartford operated by the Root Center, the state's largest methadone treatment provider. Schumann wasn't excited about making the 20-mile commute 6 days a week. He did so because for the past 9 years, the Root Center's clinic in downtown Hartford was the closest medication-assisted treatment center available to him. Schumann, who became dependent on opioids after initially being prescribed painkillers to treat the symptoms of pancreatitis, said during the first couple of months of his methadone treatment in 2015, the distance between his home and the Hartford clinic was extremely difficult to overcome. The car he was using broke down shortly after he began making the half-hour commute. That setback resulted in him taking a 3 to 4 hour round-trip bus ride to Hartford for more than a month, which was a major hassle while he was in the nascent stage of recovery. Schumann said he was able to overcome the significant commute time by forming a daily routine, which required him to get up before dawn so that he could reach the treatment center by 5:30 a.m. "It took me a long time to get where I am now," he said. But other Middletown residents who sought out treatment did not have the same success that Schumann did when faced with the prospect of traveling to clinics in Hartford, New Britain, or Manchester every day. Next article is titled, "What Are Peer-Run Respite Centers? Why Some Connecticut Lawmakers Are Pushing for Alternatives to Psychiatric Facilities," by Allison Cross for the Hartford Current. When Jennifer Tirado ran into the woods during a mental health crisis, the officer who chased after her told Tirado she had two options. She could either come with him willingly, or he would have to restrain her. Either way, Tirado knew she would be going to the hospital. "In that moment," said Tirado, "I didn't feel like I had a choice." For Tirado and so many others who struggle with suicidal ideation, self-injury, and other psychiatric conditions, encounters with involuntary commitment are fraught with false choices, experiences within the mental health system that Tirado said often result in more harm than healing. Tirado is part of a coalition of advocates in Connecticut working to establish peer-run respite centers as an alternative to hospitalization when individuals experience a mental health crisis. Unlike locked inpatient facilities, peer respites provide voluntary, non-clinical, community-based support in a home-like environment that allows guests to maintain connections to their support networks as they heal. There are no curfews. Folks can come and go from the house as they please. People can continue to work, meet with loved ones, and keep up their regular activities while they receive support from trained peer specialists who have experienced similar mental health challenges. Senate Bill 370, which currently awaits a vote in the Senate, would add 8 peer respites to the state. The bill, which comes at an annual price tag of $5.5 million, sailed through the Public Health Committee in a unanimous vote after a public hearing in which testifiers expressed their unanimous support for the proposal. If passed by the General Assembly, the legislation would require the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services to develop a network of 8 peer-run respite centers in Connecticut, one in each of the state's 5 mental health regions, and 3 additional affinity-specific centers dedicated to the transgender, queer, intersex, and gender nonconforming community, the Black, Indigenous, and people of color community, and the Spanish-speaking community. At least 15 states are currently home to peer respites, according to advocates who believe the peer model could transform Connecticut's mental health landscape. Dr. Leigh Nathan told Connecticut lawmakers that if she could design a place for people to find aid during an emotional crisis. It would look exactly like the peer respite centers proposed in the bill. Every day, Nathan sees the impact of severe injury from emotional distress. Many of her patients are the survivors of recent suicide attempts. As a practicing psychiatrist at Hartford Hospital and the clinical lead of person-centered care at the hospital's psychiatric facility, the Institute of Living, Nathan said she often thinks about what the healthcare system could do differently to prevent self-injury. Nathan said that when she asks patients, "If you had a person to talk to about this who wasn't a doctor, do you think maybe you wouldn't have made this attempt?" And the answer is often yes. Nathan said that every patient's circumstance is different, and that speaking to a clinical provider about thoughts of suicide or self-harm will not automatically result in an involuntary hospitalization. She stressed that such outcomes are supposed to occur only when providers have real concerns that actual harm could happen. However, said Nathan, for many patients, the very possibility of an involuntary hospitalization often stops them from discussing their feelings altogether. She said she has seen patients who have begged to be admitted into inpatient facilities and others who have been adamant about not wanting to go. And she said both experiences are valid. Some find the treatment beneficial. For others, it's a double-edged sword. There's this expression of, quote, "It's not about the destination, it's about the journey," said Nathan. Some people may get to a place where they're feeling better, but they had to go through some really uncomfortable experiences, like a locked psychiatric hospital, for example, to get there. Nathan said she's hopeful that peer respite centers will be an avenue for people to get to the destination of feeling better without going through an involuntary treatment setting. "This is the kind of thing that can change the trajectory of someone's life," said Nathan. If you or someone you know is in mental health distress or is thinking of suicide, please call or text 988 for the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, or chat at www.988lifeline.org. In an emergency, call or text 911. The next article is titled, "A Connecticut Man Had Three Strokes at 40 and One in a Million Rare Disease. Here's What Doctors Did," by Ed Stannard for the Hartford Courant. Carnell Harrison suffered a series of strokes at just over 40 years old. Having multiple strokes at that age is strange enough, but the reason is also odd. Harrison, who lives in Waterbury, went to Hartford Hospital after his third stroke and was diagnosed with Moyamoya disease, a rare genetic disorder in which the carotid arteries leading to the brain become narrowed. The strange thing is that it normally affects children and often is seen in those of Asian descent. "On a population level, I think it's about one in a million," said Dr. Eric Sussman, Harrison's neurosurgeon. "It's a very, very rare disease, but it's a very impactful disease because it tends to occur in young patients, and it tends to cause recurrent strokes. And so in terms of the duration of an otherwise young, healthy life that's affected by the disease, it's really significant. What happens is the blood vessels going into the brain just get progressively more narrow over time until they eventually close off," said Sussman. To treat Harrison's condition, Sussman performed a delicate procedure involving blood vessels that are about 1 millimeter in diameter, bypassing the carotid arteries on both sides of his brain. Harrison said after his first stroke, "I had issues with my leg, and I was going to physical therapy. So I went maybe like 6-8 months or some, and then I was back walking normal. That's when he began having memory issues, which he still deals with. My memory is horrible, and my fatigue from the first stroke is still bad," he said. When Harrison arrived at Hartford Hospital, he was having his third stroke on his left side. Once that passed, Sussman said, "We started with that side. We dissected out the superficial temporal artery in the scalp and then made a small opening through the skull to expose the surface of the brain and then sewed the superficial temporal artery into a blood vessel on the surface of the brain called the middle cerebral artery," he said. A month or two later, Harrison had the surgery on the other side of his brain. "He did really, really well," said Sussman. "It's been now over a year since the surgery, and he hasn't had another stroke. And obviously, that's a big win for somebody his age, who was having multiple strokes over the course of just a few months or a year before the surgery." Harrison said that besides his memory, he is unable to pick up anything as heavy as a gallon of milk. He can no longer work at his construction job. His son, Carnell, 9, helps out a lot. "Oh, he's awesome," said Harrison. "He helps me any way I need it, really. Like, he brings the milk in when we go shopping." For him to be so young, it was so frustrating to him, said Harrison's mother, Tina Harrison, who came up from Charlotte, North Carolina, to stay with her son. So frustrating, because he couldn't believe that this was happening to him. She said Carnell Harrison tried to go back to work after his first stroke, but he couldn't do it. "It's been a journey, I'm telling you, but he's a trooper," said Tina Harrison. May 6th happens to be Moya Moya Awareness Day, and Hartford Healthcare will be joining others at the state capitol to highlight it. "There's not very many medical centers in the world who are doing this procedure, and we're one of them," said Sussman. "So I think that's a great thing to have here in Hartford. We have this upcoming International Moya Moya Day, and the Moya Moya Foundation is coming to Hartford, and we're going to the Connecticut State Legislative Building and to try to highlight this disease and raise awareness for it," he said. The next article is titled "Connecticut Greenhouse Gas Emissions Up as Climate Change Bills Languish," by Jan Ellen Spiegel for the Connecticut Mirror. As bills aimed at dealing with climate change struggle to get through the current legislative session, a new report showing that Connecticut is struggling with its greenhouse gas emissions may be providing an extra push. Data from the state's annual greenhouse gas emissions inventory, released recently, shows that there was a sharp increase in GHG emissions, the primary cause of planet warming climate change, of 6% from 2020 to 2021. The two-year increase from 2020 to 2022 was 7%. It mirrors a similar increase of overall greenhouse gas emissions in the federal inventory released by the Environmental Protection Agency recently. In both cases, part, though not all, of the increase can be attributed to the economy ramping back up after the shutdown during the first year of COVID. And in both cases, the transportation sector is responsible for the largest amount of emissions. In Connecticut, transportation emissions have increased sharply since 2020. Between 2021 and 2022, they increased 4%. And are now only 1% below transportation emissions in 1990. One of the benchmarks used for comparison in the state's Global Warming Solutions Act. In terms of percentages, transportation in Connecticut accounts for 42% of total emissions, far more pronounced than nationally, where it is 28%. Transportation emissions in Connecticut are also more than the combined emissions of the next two sectors, heating in residential and commercial buildings at 21% and 13% respectively. Emissions in both those sectors also increased in 2021 and 2022. On the other side of the ledger, there was a continued and sharp decline in emissions from the electric power sector. 2022 levels were 16% below 2021 levels and down 80% from their 1990 level. This drop is due to lower demand, much of it the result of increased amounts of rooftop solar as well as increasing amounts of renewable energy on the electric grid. The state did meet its 2020 mandate to reduce economy-wide GHG emissions 10% from 1990 levels, but it has been backsliding since then and is way off target to meet its next metric, 45% below 2001 levels by 2030. Quote, "We need to step up the pace. We need to accelerate the rate of reductions of greenhouse gas emissions if we are going to meet the goals that the legislature has established in the Global Warming Solutions Act," said the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection Commissioner Katie Dykes during the recent announcement. Achieving that target will require an average reduction of about 1.1 million metric tons of carbon dioxide each year between 2022 and 2030. Connecticut has not yet achieved a rate like that to date. We will also need to substantially increase the pace of reductions over the next 5 years to meet that 2030 goal. Efforts in Connecticut to deal with the biggest contributor, transportation emissions, have been repeatedly derailed by state legislators. The most recent failed attempt involved adopting strict California standards for cars and light-duty trucks that would phase cut the purchase of new gasoline motor vehicles by 2035 and also set zero-emission standards for heavy-duty vehicles. The state now follows looser federal standards, and the only legislation on this issue this session would revise and coordinate programs and infrastructure for zero-emission vehicles. Dykes pointed out, as she has repeatedly in the last several years, that big emissions declines will be needed in transportation. We know what we need to do to accomplish that. The increased adoption of zero-emission vehicles is going to be really important. We also know that we're driving more than ever, she said. The report pointed out that reductions in emissions through improved fuel economy in motor vehicles have been almost entirely offset by increased emissions from driving more. Legislative opposition to widespread EV adoption, both Republican and Democratic, has focused on the cost of EVs and the lack of charging infrastructure, especially in rural areas. Connecticut recently joined with its neighboring states to apply for federal funding for two major transmission initiatives. The administration also announced a new 5-year offshore wind leasing schedule that will include several areas in the Atlantic off New England and New York. And all states recently learned that they would receive funding to expand solar adoption, specifically aimed at low-income populations. Connecticut will receive more than $62 million of the $7 million funding pot. But the focus right now is on what the legislature will or won't do to put emissions reduction policies in place. Quote, "Given the trajectory that we're on, it's clear that we have a really tough road ahead of us preparing for the impacts of climate change," said Charles Rothenberger, climate and energy attorney at Save the Sound. He said addressing the transportation and building sectors would be critical. Quote, "It's even more important that we take the proactive action to reduce our climate emissions in order to avoid even more catastrophic impacts," he said. "We face a challenge of needing to decrease our emissions at a much quicker and steeper pace to meet our greenhouse gas reduction targets than we have to date. And it's clear policies have to be aligned with the urgency of these goals." The next article is titled, "There's a Loophole in Connecticut Cannabis Law. THC-infused drinks found it, and they are everywhere," by Erica Phillips for the Connecticut Mirror. Connecticut lawmakers are making final adjustments to a bill that would, for the first time, regulate the sale and potency of THC-infused beverages and other consumer products containing THC derived from hemp. While medicinal and adult-use cannabis products are highly regulated in the state, hemp-derived products with the levels of THC considered intoxicating have found their way onto retail store shelves, where they're sold without age restrictions. That loophole, as State Attorney General William Tong and several lawmakers have called it, originated with the Federal Agricultural Improvement Act of 2018, which legalized hemp production, and the subsequent state legislation that authorized it in Connecticut. That allowed hemp producers in the state to make products that have certain amounts of THC in them, said Representative Mike D'Agostino, Democrat of Hamden. Quote, I'm not sure if everyone appreciated at the time that these were intoxicating THC products. Nevertheless, that's the current state of the law in Connecticut and the law that existed before we legalized cannabis. These products, which include THC-infused drinks as well as edibles, oils, and concentrates derived from the hemp plant, are currently sold in CBD and package stores, convenience stores, supermarkets, and other retailers. Some restaurants and bars offer hemp-derived seltzers on their menus. Seltzer producers, retailers, and their customers pushed back on the regulations initially proposed in House Bill 5150, which would have limited the products to 0.5 milligrams of THC per serving. That limit was recently adjusted in the bill to 1 milligram per serving, allowing sales in package stores and cannabis dispensaries. Joe Grabowski, co-owner of Serene Craft Beer Distributors in Bridgeport, told legislators that hemp-derived beverages have helped his business remain profitable amid declining sales of alcoholic products. Quote, we're actively looking to add staff and infrastructure in 2024, but if this bill is passed as written, we will have layoffs, as our sales will no longer justify current staffing levels, Grabowski wrote in testimony submitted to the legislature's General Law Committee, which raised the bill. This is not a unique situation to just our business. The alcohol industry as a whole is suffering, and some of this is a direct result of the legalization of cannabis in this state. But some cannabis businesses, which went through an arduous application and lottery process to obtain licenses to sell THC products, say allowing anyone else to sell those products goes against the spirit of the law. The cannabis industry would prefer to be the ones producing, manufacturing, and selling those beverages, said Adam Wood, president of the Connecticut Cannabis Chamber of Commerce. The regulated industry wouldn't want to see a product offering that is in any way similar to the product it's selling, because that would sort of destroy the market for cannabis products. The latest version of the legislation doesn't resolve that particular issue, but it would limit sales of the various hemp-derived, THC-infused products to CBD and package stores, as well as cannabis dispensaries. It would also require all products to undergo testing and meet certain other requirements akin to those that cannabis products must meet. No more convenience stores, no more at your gas station, no more kids can go buy them, D'Agostino, who co-chairs the General Law Committee, said. If it's going to exist, it's going to be strictly regulated. The sweeping bill contains provisions that met with support and opposition from cannabis retailers and medical dispensaries. It limits costly requirements for on-site vaults, which would reduce costs for businesses, a change they welcome. But it also bans those businesses from offering promotional sales and discounts. The Cannabis Chamber said a ban on promotions impedes the growth and success of the industry in a state where pricing is already much higher than our neighboring states. But chamber members said they expect to broach broader discussions of the issue of cannabis packaging and branding, which is strictly limited in Connecticut, during next year's legislative session. That's all the time we have for in this week's look at For Your Health. If you have questions about this or other programs on Chris Radio, call the listener line at 860-727-9579. I'm Beth Gibbs. So long until next time.
Hello and welcome. to some interesting and helpful information on diabetes. Resistant starch diet may aid weight loss and boost insulin sensitivity. Obesity is now recognized as a worldwide health crisis, contributing to global mortality by elevating the risk of metabolic disorders like diabetes and increasing the likelihood of cardiovascular disease. Losing weight through diet and exercise is an important measure to prevent or reduce obesity. Research increasingly shows the gut microbiota's link to how the body handles glucose and fats and also how it affects inflammation. While fecal microbiota transplantation, which aims to induce the proliferation of good gut bacteria, has seen mixed success in promoting a healthy gut, dietary modifications have proven to impact the microbiota positively, suggesting that diet-based approaches, alone or in combination with transplantation, could improve health outcomes. Resistant starch is not digestible by human-produced amylase enzymes and acts as a form of dietary fiber. It passes through the stomach and small intestine undigested, reaching the large intestine or colon where it is fermented by the gut microbiota. Studies in rodents have demonstrated that diets high in resistant starch can lead to reduced body fat and improved metabolic health. In a new study published in Nature Metabolism, researchers modified the gut microbiota of human participants by increasing dietary fiber to investigate how it might help manage insulin resistance while also reducing weight. Researchers conducted a randomized crossover clinical trial to assess the impact of resistant starch sourced from high amylose maize on obesity and metabolic health. Participants not on probiotics, antibiotics, or treatments affecting glucose metabolism were divided into a treatment group receiving resistant starch and a control group receiving amylopectin. The trial involved consuming the assigned starch in powdered form twice daily before meals over 2 8-week phases, allowing for direct comparison between the effects of resistant starch and the control. The research also investigated how gut microbiota modified by resistant starch supplementation affect glucose metabolism and fat accumulation to understand the metabolic benefit. The findings indicated that adding resistant starch to the diet resulted in an average weight reduction of approximately 2.8 kilograms and enhanced insulin sensitivity among individuals with overweight. Researchers observed that the positive effects of resistant starch on health were primarily due to alterations in the composition of the gut microbiota. Specifically, the presence of the bacterium Bifidobacterium adolescentis was significantly linked to the intake of resistant starch in humans, and introducing this bacterium alone to mice safeguarded them against obesity caused by their diet. The research concluded that adding resistant starch to the diet leads to weight reduction and enhances insulin sensitivity, primarily by boosting the presence of B adolescentis in the gut microbiota. Three experts not involved in this research spoke to Medical News Today about its findings. Dr. Mir Ali, bariatric surgeon and medical director of Memorial Care Surgical Weight Loss Center at Orange Coast Medical Center in Fountain Valley, California, said that this paper highlights the importance of the gut microbiota and the role it plays not just for weight loss but overall health as well. Kelsey Costa, MSRDN, a registered dietitian nutritionist and founder of Dietarian Insights Collaborative, agreed, noting that the research surrounding resistant starch is a burgeoning area of interest in the nutritional science field. The weight loss observed in this study is linked to alterations in the composition of gut microbiota, specifically the increase of Bifidobacterium adolescentis, which was significantly associated with obesity reduction in the participants and has shown protective effects against diet-induced obesity in male mice, Costa explained. As we continue to unravel the multifaceted relationships between diet, gut microbiota, and human health, the potential of resistant starch as a functional food ingredient for obesity management and metabolic health improvement remains an exciting and valuable area of exploration. Megan Hilbert, MSRDN, a registered dietitian specializing in gut health nutrition from Top Nutrition Coaching, said that based on this study's findings, resistant starch proved to be an effective way to reduce obesity as well as insulin sensitivity in participants who received the resistant starch intervention. Dr. Ali noted several implications of this research. For example, by reestablishing a healthy gut microbiota, it could help facilitate weight loss. Of course, there is much more research that needs to be done in this area, Dr. Ali said. Also, the intestinal microbiota is not the only factor that affects a patient's weight and overall health. Patients need to understand that there are many components to a healthy weight loss plan and maintenance of weight and health. Genetics, lifestyle, exercise, and healthy gut microbiome all play a role, but the majority of weight loss is due to the change in diet. Hilbert noted how clinicians can thankfully easily apply these findings to our work with our patients by educating these individuals more on how to include foods high in resistant starch. Resistant starch occurs naturally in many foods like oats, cooked and cooled rice, grains like sorghum and barley, beans and legumes like black beans, peas, pinto beans, etc., raw potato starch, or cooked and cooled potatoes, green bananas, and more, she explained. It's also possible to supplement with resistant starch, but I recommend trying to get resistant starch through whole foods to get health benefits from the other aspects of these foods, vitamins, minerals, protein, prebiotics, other fibers, Hilbert suggested. When adding in more resistant starch, I usually advise people to start slow and allow the gut microbiota to adapt to changes if they aren't used to eating much fiber or resistant starch to avoid any unpleasant side effects, she said. Costa explained that resistant starch is distinguished as a distinct dietary fiber that bypasses digestion in the small intestine and undergoes fermentation in the colon, where it interacts with gut microbiota, potentially leading to a significant reduction in body fat based on the findings from animal studies. However, while rodent studies have highlighted the potential for resistant starch to influence metabolic outcomes favorably, previous human studies have been limited and observed little body weight alterations following resistant starch supplementation, suggesting variable effects on human metabolic health, Costa said. Costa explained that research indicates that the fat content in diets affects the fermentation and health benefits of resistant starch. High-fat diets can negatively impact our gut microbiota, hindering resistant starch's benefits, while low-fat diets enhance its fermentation, promoting metabolic health. This highlights the importance of whole plant-based foods for optimal resistant starch intake and health outcomes. The findings bolster the argument for a dietary shift toward plant-based nutrition, highlighting the inherent health benefits and the role of resistant starch in fostering a healthier gut microbiome and promoting optimal metabolic health. Tobacco exposure before birth and in childhood can increase type 2 diabetes risk, from Medical News Today. New research shows that early exposure to tobacco, whether in the womb or during childhood and adolescence, has a strong correlation with the development of type 2 diabetes later in life. The large-scale observational analysis pulled records of about 476,000 adults in the UK Biobank. The findings, which have not been published yet in a peer-reviewed journal, were presented this week at the annual American Heart Association's Epidemiology and Prevention Lifestyle and Cardiometabolic Scientific Sessions in Chicago. While the data only shows correlation and not causation, it adds to the body of evidence that correlates tobacco exposure with poor health, particularly for those who are exposed early in life. This emphasizes the importance of preventing tobacco exposures in early life stages, including during pregnancy, especially for people with high genetic risk for type 2 diabetes, Victor Wenz Zong, a senior study author and professor and chair of the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at Shanghai Jiao Tong University School of Medicine in China, told Medical News Today. Adopting a healthy lifestyle later in adulthood could lower the risk of type 2 diabetes among people who have had tobacco exposure in utero, childhood, or adolescence, he added. It has already been established that smoking and tobacco exposure are associated with a host of negative health outcomes, such as cancer, heart disease, stroke, and diabetes. The study authors reported that people who started smoking in childhood had double the risk of type 2 diabetes. In addition, those who started smoking as adolescents had a 57% higher risk, while those who started smoking as adults had a 33% higher risk of developing type 2 diabetes compared to those who never smoked. The study categorized childhood as ages 5 to 14 and adolescence as ages 15 to 17. Those with a genetic predisposition for type 2 diabetes faced a higher risk. Dr. Robert Eckel, an endocrinologist and past president of the American Heart Association, who was not involved in the study, told Medical News Today that while the research carries some caveats in terms of being observational, it could help physicians better understand the association between tobacco and type 2 diabetes. I think we've known for some time that tobacco utilization is associated with all kinds of adverse effects. Type 2 diabetes, cancer, hypertension, and many others that affect the cardiometabolic space, he explained. So the idea that tobacco is potentially insightful for the diagnosis of type 2 diabetes is really important. While the correlation is established, proving causation is more elusive. Eckel said that a clue could lie in the fact that tobacco exposure is associated with insulin resistance, but there are many factors, genetic and otherwise, at play. The analysis also found that adopting a healthy lifestyle later in adulthood could lower the risk of developing type 2 diabetes, even for those who were exposed to tobacco early in life. Smoking is still commonplace, but its prevalence has been on a downward trajectory for decades. About 42% of U.S. adults were smokers in 1965, while under 14% were smokers in 2018. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that the number fell to less than 12% in 2021. There's been a concerted effort made to curb smoking, from labeling products that contain tobacco to public education and public regulations, Eckel explained. While numbers are lower, they're still nowhere near zero. The number of U.S. adults who smoke still amounts to 28 million people, and cigarette smoking is still the leading cause of preventable disease and death in the United States. Eckel said that for those who might need one more reason to quit smoking, it's worth considering that their polygenic risk for type 2 diabetes could make them even more susceptible to developing the condition if they smoke, adding that many people have no idea what their risk factor may be. I think type 2 diabetes is something we don't want in addition to all the other risks that relate to tobacco utilization, he said. So the take-home message is that if you've been exposed to tobacco when you were young, It's time to get your lifestyle activated in a way that would prevent excess body weight gain and understand what your risk factors may be. Too high or too low glucose levels may slow cognition in people with type 1 diabetes. Source: Medical News Today. As of 2021, about 8.4 million people around the world had type 1 diabetes. Researchers project this number will increase by approximately 500,000 new cases every year, with a worldwide projection as high as 17.4 million individuals with type 1 diabetes by 2040. Unlike type 2 diabetes, type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disease for which there is currently no cure. This type of diabetes negatively affects the pancreas so that it can no longer produce enough insulin, a hormone that helps the body manage its blood sugar levels. Previous studies show that people with type 1 diabetes are at an increased risk for several health conditions, including cardiovascular disease, nerve damage, eye problems, and cognition issues. Now, researchers from McLean Hospital, a member of Mass General Brigham, believe the naturally occurring glucose level fluctuation in people with type 1 diabetes may impact how well their brains work. The study was recently published in the journal Digital Medicine. According to Dr. Zoe Hawks, director of the Computational Modeling and Cognitive Dynamics Program at McLean Hospital, instructor in psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, and lead author of this study, doctors and researchers need to have a better understanding of how type 1 diabetes affects the brain. Individuals with type 1 diabetes are at increased risk for cognitive impairment, and cognitive variability is an important indicator of long-term brain health, Dr. Hawks explained to Medical News Today. Understanding how glucose impacts cognitive variability in the context of clinical risk factors, for example, microvascular complications, may support the development of new tools to evaluate and monitor brain health in type 1 diabetes. Past studies have linked type 1 diabetes to cognitive issues. For example, a study published in March 2022 discovered that older adults with type 1 diabetes had significantly poorer cognition compared to those with type 2 diabetes or without diabetes. Research published in November 2018 found that older adults with type 1 diabetes who had suboptimal or poor glycemic control of diabetes were at an increased risk for dementia. A study published in July 2021 reported that severe hypoglycemic and hyperglycemic events increased dementia risk in older adults with type 1 diabetes. For this study, Dr. Hawks and her team recruited 200 people with type 1 diabetes who used digital glucose sensors and smartphone-based cognitive tests to collect glucose levels and cognition data three times a day for 15 days. Type 1 diabetes is characterized by elevated glucose and increased glucose variability, Dr. Hawks said. Previous laboratory studies have shown that extreme glucose levels impair cognition. However, due to technological limitations, it's historically been difficult to study the impact of glucose on cognition outside of the laboratory. We were interested in using new remote data collection technologies to understand how glucose impacts cognition in everyday life and whether this effect differs from person to person, she explained. When analyzing the collected data, scientists found that the cognitive function of processing speed, how quickly the brain receives, processes, and responds to received information, was impaired when a person's glucose levels were either considerably higher or lower than usual. However, this was not true for another cognitive function called sustained attention, the ability to focus on a specific task for a long time. This finding was unexpected but not altogether surprising, Dr. Hawkes said. It may reflect the fact that glycemic variability impacts sustained attention and processing speed on different timescales. For example, recent work by Paytak and colleagues suggested that sustained attention varies in relation to longer-term effects of glucose, for example, over hours and days, whereas we found that processing speed is sensitive to current glycemic status, she said. Study researchers also discovered that a study participant's peak cognitive performance coincided with glucose levels being slightly higher than their usual range. However, their performance dropped if their glucose levels continued to rise. This was surprising. We know high glucose is bad for long-term brain functioning and cognitive health, but it looks like, at least in the short term, having glucose that is moderately high is associated with faster thinking and response times in people with type 1 diabetes, so says Dr. Zoe Hawkes. This is important for patients to know because it means that if someone is working hard to lower their blood glucose to a healthier range, they might notice that their thinking is a little slower than usual. We expect that these are short-term effects as their body adjusts to a lower glucose level. People with higher average glucose had slower average thinking speed than people with lower average glucose, Dr. Hawkes explained. Dr. Hawkes said there are two big takeaways from this study that medical professionals should be aware of. First, the same glucose level could be associated with thinking difficulties for one person and not for another person, supporting an individualized approach that acknowledges that no two patients are exactly alike in how their glucose impacts their cognition, she said. Second, contrary to what many of us believed, mild to moderately high glucose did not seem to be associated with thinking difficulties, Dr. Hawkes continued. If a person with type 1 diabetes was about to engage in high-stakes testing, for example, and their glucose was a little bit high, they shouldn't worry about it for that test, as this range was associated with good cognitive functioning overall. After reviewing this study, Dr. Swapnil Patel, vice chairman of the Department of Medicine at Hackensack Meridian Jersey Shore University Medical Center in New Jersey, told MNT it is fascinating to see how glycemic control can impact the brain in so many different ways. This study verifies that there is much to learn about how type 1 diabetes and glycemic control can affect the brain in the short term and the long term, Dr. Patel continued. It is also great to see how the advent of the continuous glucose monitor has improved our knowledge about diabetes and our ability to improve glucose control. This article demonstrates the importance of glycemic control in daily brain health. Additional studies would be important to further validate this information. It also would be important to see how the use of continuous glucose monitor technology can further be leveraged to learn more about glycemic control and its impact, Dr. Swapnil Patel said. MNT also spoke with Dr. Jennifer Cheng, Section Chief of Endocrinology at Hackensack Meridian Jersey Shore University Medical Center in New Jersey, about this research. Dr. Cheng said this study is reflective of what is seen in clinical practice. The study mentions that perhaps patients habituate and adapt to a certain sugar level, she continued. It would be interesting to see additional research on what sugar level patients get used to and how their cognitive performance changes over time after getting sugars under better glycemic control. It would be interesting to see if the best cognitive performance is due to patients' feelings or due to actual performance. Another area of research that would be interesting to see the results is to what degree of brain damage is occurring in our patients with diabetes who are having recurrent hypoglycemia, Dr. Cheng added. And from Medical News Today, activity snacks could lower blood sugar, complication risks in type 1 diabetes. Being sedentary for extended periods of time is considered to be unhealthy for anyone. It is of special concern for people with type 1 diabetes, since it is associated with the dysregulation of insulin levels. At the same time, being too active can cause sudden, precipitous drops in blood sugar levels for people with type 1 diabetes. A new study from the University of Sunderland in the United Kingdom demonstrates a middle ground, a way for people with type 1 diabetes to keep their blood sugar under control with safe, short periods of light-intensity walking. The authors call these exercise snacks. The study finds that taking a 3-minute stroll after every 30 minutes of sedentary time helped study participants keep their blood sugar under control compared to people who were sedentary. In addition, the researchers found that the light walking breaks did not put the participants at a risk of sudden drops in blood glucose levels. The researchers presented their recent findings at the Diabetes UK Professional Conference 2023. They also published a review drawing similar conclusions in the Canadian Journal of Diabetes. The study involved 32 adults with type 1 diabetes and consisted of two sessions conducted over a period of 2 weeks. In the first, participants remained seated for 7 hours. In the second, they got up every 30 minutes for a light 3-minute walk. After each of the sessions, participants were outfitted with a continuous glucose monitor for 48 hours. During that period, researchers requested that they adhere to their standard insulin prescriptions and levels of activity. They also all ate a standardized breakfast and lunch. The researchers found that after the short walks, individuals maintained a blood sugar average of 6.9 millimoles per liter. Their blood sugar levels were higher, 8.2 millimoles, after the extended sit-downs. Over 48 hours of monitoring during and after the test period, the blood sugar levels remained in the target range by 14% higher in the participants who took exercise snacks compared to those who did not. This study is interesting, commented David Sumera Ahmed, an assistant professor at the College of Osteopathic Medicine at Truro University, California, who was not involved in the study. It is exciting to recognize that even frequent low-intensity and very short-duration activities can help improve the time in range for people with type 1 diabetes. More importantly, it avoids hypoglycemia, she noted. And that's it for today's reading of the Diabetes News. I'm Ken, your volunteer reader here at the Talking Information Center. And please forgive me for mangling the names, medical conditions, and drug names. Thank you for listening.